there is a way to get the schedule award for that. But again, everybody I've seen with long COVID is on OWCP, long-term disability compensation. If you want to apply for the schedule award, which you can do, if you die from the condition, then you get your surviving representative can receive the schedule award.
Breaking OWCP podcast, Chris and Jeannie. As you can see, Jeannie is not here, but our good friend, attorney Eric Flowers is. And today we're talking about schedule awards. We're just going to jump right into it. Eric, when I go to, and I think you've heard me do it, I go to union meetings and I say, who here has heard of a schedule award? And like two people will raise their hand. And then I say, who's heard of money? Gets a laugh, but everybody raises their hand. Yeah. What's a schedule award?
Schedule award is a payment for a permanent impairment pursuant to a federal statute that allows, it mandates the government must pay an injured worker for a permanent impairment they've sustained as a result of a work-related injury. There are certain body parts that are compensable. The body parts that are not compensable for a scheduled award, the big ones are back, neck, brain, and heart.
So let's just stop there. So another thing I say is if you're looking for fairness in this system, it's not about fair. The spine is not rated, with the exceptions that you'll discuss, but the back is not rated.
Yeah, I hate lawyers because there's an exception to every rule.
Freaking lawyers.
But you're right. The back is not in the American Medical Association guides to the evaluation of permanent impairment, which is what we use for determining impairments. The spine is rateable, but the federal government does not have it on their schedule. The federal, and I say schedule. Schedule means it's part of a federal statute. They put a schedule in there, so they value body parts. An arm is valued at 312 weeks. A leg is valued at 288 weeks. They value organs. Kidneys are valued. Lungs are valued. There's a lot of different organs that are valued. But where we specialize and see the most value is the lower extremities, the hips, the knees, the ankles. That's where we specialize. The shoulders, we do if there's a shoulder replacement, there's value there. When I say there's value there, there's value so that someone would justifiably understand why they need our services.
Right.
We don't take all scheduled award cases. We won't take carpal tunnel syndrome. It's only about a 2% award. It's not valuable enough for someone to come seek our services for an award like that.
In other words, someone would come to you and say, Eric, help me get a schedule award for my carpal tunnel syndrome, and it would cost them more than they would get back.
That's correct.
That's what you mean by the value.
Yeah, and I won't take a case where I don't bring value to someone. I just won't do it.
You're not going to let your clients lose money.
I'm not going to let my clients lose money. And our services are valuable in that if someone is not deriving a obvious benefit, I'm not going to take the case. I just won't do it. I know what value is and I know what value isn't. If I can't help them, or if I can't help them get a case won, there's cases coming to me and I'm like, I can't win that. I'm not going to take it. I won't do it.
So I hear you say the brain is not rateable. So if someone is in a massive car accident, which happens to letter carriers 26,000 times a year, and they get a head injury, they can't get an impairment rating for that.
Not for a brain injury. No. A head injury, possibly if they get a bad scar in their face, that's possible. Again, exception for everything, but yeah. The brain is not rateable. So a traumatic brain injury is not rateable. You're correct.
What if it causes problems in the arms or legs? And now your arms don't work. Your legs don't work.
If you have a neck injury or a lower back injury with radiculopathy, which is a motor or sensory deprivation in the limbs, then yes, it's possible to get a scheduled award for that. That is determined by a EMG or an NCVS study, a nerve conduction velocity study, that could possibly result in a scheduled award for those body members. However, what we see a lot of times is somebody is diagnosed with lumbar radiculopathy.
Yeah.
That in and of itself from a back injury does entitle them to a scheduled award for the lower limbs, but they may also have osteoarthritis in the ankles, knees, or hips. We can then get them a schedule award for the ankles, knees, or hips because a body member is rated as a whole on the date of impairment rating. So once you have a covered body member as an accepted condition, you can get a schedule award for that, even though it may not be related to your original injury.
So are you saying if I have a knee injury, I can obviously get a schedule award on my knee.
Correct.
But if I have a deficit in my ankle, you can combine the ankle deficit with the knee, even though the ankle had nothing to do with work.
That's correct.
Most people have no idea that's a real thing.
No, and that's it's an exception to the rule why everybody hates lawyers. There's exceptions to every rule. But that is true. I look for value. When someone calls me and says, hey, I had an example. I had a call today with a lady who has bilateral osteoarthritis accepted as a claim. And she says her knees are bothering her, but my hips hurt more. Well, she's got bilateral osteoarthritis already accepted. I can get her hips included in that schedule award.
Wow.
So that's a case I would take because I can add value to it. And she does not know what she's entitled to. She's not going to get it with any other lawyer. 99.99% of lawyers in the country are not going to understand how to get her the value. So I would take that case because I know I'm going to bring her money that she would not get otherwise.
Well, and also the doctors don't know that. I've been working with doctors since I was a little boy. Mm-hmm. And it was not until I met you that I heard that.
Well, it's a little known provision of the Federal Employees Compensation Act that and OWCP, the U.S. Department of Labor, is gracious enough to allow that to take place.
Yeah,
we know the rules inside and out. We do today. They're getting ready to change a little bit, we think. And we have to learn it. But again, nobody else knows this stuff like we do. And we do know how to drive value.
So I'm trying to think of what questions people ask me all the time on impairment ratings and schedule awards. And the most common one is, how much can I get for blank? So I have a knee. How much can I get for my knee? How much can I get for my shoulder?
It depends. Osteoarthritis, bone on bone, is generally a 50% rating of the lower limb. When you start taking, and I've seen this, where...
I'm sorry, 50%?
50% of 288 weeks. So it's 144 weeks of your pay rate, mm-hmm. date of injury pay rate, or date of last exposure pay rate. So we get people that come in with a date of injury of, say, 2012. They'll say, hey, I realized in 2012 I was a letter carrier for 30 years. In 2012, I started to receive treatment for my knees. They began bothering me in 2012, but I stayed on my job. And I have this exact case in an individual out of Georgia right now. He stayed on his job, and he's still working his job. Been there for 29 years now. So what pay rate is he paid at? The date of injury in 2012 or his date of last exposure, which is today? He's still working. So his pay rate, which is a very important factor in the determination of how much money you get, is today, which is a higher pay rate than he was receiving in 2012. So we look at a lot of factors. And when somebody comes to me with a case, my mind is going in 10 different directions because I'm thinking date of injury, date of last exposure, date of last pay raise. There's a lot of factors that go into it because I'm trying to maximize value. That's my job, to maximize value for a client. So I'm sorry, what was the question? I got on a tangent.
The most common question that I get is, how much money can I get for a certain body part?
So the leg is at 288 weeks and the arm is at 312 weeks. Those are the two I deal with the most. But it seems like most clients who come to us have multiple issues that they're dealing with, especially with postal workers, federal agents. So a lot of federal agents come to us with shoulder, hip, knee, ankle, elbow, wrist. I mean, we see it all.
Yeah.
So we're trying to get one part of the arms, one part of the legs accepted, so the entire body member is rateable. There also comes into play combined values chart in the American Medical Association guides. They have to take into account. So the knee may get 50% because you're bone on bone. Your hip, and I've seen this, is also bone on bone. So you'd think you'd add 50 and 50 to have 100% impairment. No, that's not the way it works. You got to go to the combined values chart and figure out what 50 and 50 comes out to, which is probably 78%.
Which is still a huge number.
Still a huge number, especially if you have some high pay rate people. When we do, we see a lot of Bureau of Prison guards mm-hmm. who have spent 20, 25 years walking on cement and up and down stairs. Their legs and hips are, their knees and hips are shot. And they get in a lot of fights. I've seen a lot of them with shoulder issues.
Well, every time we see them, somebody, you know, you have like a parade of people that say, I just got hurt fighting somebody. Happens all the time.
And I've seen shanks through the hand, broken jaws. I've seen it all with them. And I've seen body parts that are not rateable that should be rateable. Mm-hmm. It's sad. I mean, back injuries are debilitating. The problem and the reason it's been explained to me why they don't rate backs is because it's so difficult to have objective criteria from one person to another to make sure you're on the same criteria for rating individuals. a diminished joint interval spacing on a knee or a hip is very easy to determine. There are nuances to it, and we get in arguments with the Department of Labor physicians all the time on how it should be properly rated, but that's why we have the specialty that we do. No one else understands it like us, and we do bring value, so that's what we do. And individual body part ratings, COVID really hit us out of nowhere because a lot of people had diminished lung capacity as a result of COVID. A lot of those people were postal workers who still had to deliver, BOP employees who still had to work. A lot of federal employees couldn't take time off.
And well, they were essential workers.
Essential workers, right. And they were seriously injured and have lifelong impairments as a result of those conditions. Some of them, unfortunately, are going to be on OWCP for the rest of their lives, so they'll never have an opportunity to collect the scheduled award, because one exception is if you're receiving OWCP compensation, you cannot contemporaneously receive a scheduled award for the same injury.
In other words, you can't get paid by OWCP and for your scheduled award at the same time.
That's correct. If it's the same case file,
right.
That's correct. So a lot of times somebody will come to us and say, hey, I'm on OWCP periodic role benefits, meaning they're being paid for a shoulder injury, but they come to us with a knee or hip injury. We're going to start a new case so they can get that dual payment.
The other exception to the rule.
The other exception to the rule. Well, one of many, yes.
So I want to get into COVID a minute, but before we get too far past the knee, it occurred to me that another thing that I learn every time I talk to federal employees, postal employees, let's be very specific, is that the letter carrier by job description walks 8 to 10 miles a day. Mm-hmm. They carry 70-pound packages, 35-pound satchels, so it's a heavy load. They're up and down stairs. And then when you're in the room with them, you say, how many of you, just show of hands, have been with the agency 20 or more years? Nearly everybody's raising their hand. So you've got a room full of people that have walked 10 miles a day for 20 plus years. What happens to their knees? Well, often, by the way, we have Jeannie and Joe in the room. So Joe's a chiropractor. Jeannie's Jeannie. But you get osteoarthritis of the knee often. It's not that it's the rule, but gosh. You're walking 10 miles a day for 20 years. What happens to the knee? What happens to the hip? I saw somebody once that had no more arch in their foot.
Yeah, it's horrible. And Joe can tell you, osteoarthritis impacts everybody at some point in time in their life. It's the aggravation, acceleration, and or exacerbation of the condition from the work activities that brings it within the purview of the Federal Employees Compensation Act. Fortunately, the Federal Employees Compensation Act makes a standard extremely low to get the claim accepted, which is fortunate for federal employees. As difficult as it is to get the claim accepted sometimes, the standard is pretty low. You've got to do it right. You've got to make sure Federal Injury Center doctors know how to write this stuff up, know how to get the treatment approved. The process is theoretically easy. In implementation, it's somewhat difficult. I was a federal employee, and I had no idea how this process worked while I was a federal employee. When I got hurt, I used my insurance to go get stitched up and stuff. I wouldn't go to federal employees,
which is what almost everyone does right now.
And it's a mistake. I hate to say it, especially when you're trying to get a scheduled award, because these scheduled awards are life altering for some people. $500,000 scheduled award for somebody at the cusp of their retirement pays off their house and allows them to get in retirement in a very financially stable environment.
Well, and so many of these folks that we're talking about, especially the letter carrier or anybody that's just standing 8-10 hours a day for 20 years, that same thing can happen to those people as well. But they also don't realize that those aches and pains are covered conditions by OWCP. They just think, well, that's just part of life.
Yeah.
And it is part of life, but I'm not a letter carrier, so I'm probably not getting the wear and tear that they are.
Hmm. You're right. The work duties that these people engage in are far exceed what a normal office worker does. I have had a knee replacement, and I'm sure that my work activities had something to do with it. I didn't know. I never filed a claim, so I basically got nothing for it.
Right.
Postal workers, especially BOP people, there are 432 federal agencies out there. I still once in a while hear one I've never heard of before, but the physical duties that these people engage in are out of this world.
I mean, yeah.
It really is some of the things they do. And it's the repetitive nature. Even up and down from a desk all day can impact, exacerbate, accelerate a condition, and then it's compensable.
So let's connect that CA2 condition, the letter carrier who's walking 10 miles a day for 20 years. That's a CA2 most of the time. they don't realize that that's a covered condition, that they can actually file a claim on it. And if they never file a claim, what happens with their ability to get a schedule award?
If they never file a claim, they can't get one.
See, that's what I'm talking about. And that, so I want to circle it back to that. Everyone should be aware that they do this federal job. They're getting injured, even if it's just day by day by day, and it just builds up. And by doing nothing, they lose all their benefits because they're not accessing them. They're struggling with the pain of it, and they're leaving a bunch of money on the table.
Right.
Right. Tons of money.
Yeah.
Potentially.
It also disavows them of their ability to get OPM disability retirement if they can't finish out their career. And we see that all the time. I had a 23-year-old person in South Carolina, postal worker, who was just in a car accident, broken arm, broken neck, broken back, broken leg. And she was relatively new. She was an RCA.
Yeah.
So she's not even entitled to OPM disability retirement because she's not been on 18 months as a regular employee. She's got an attorney who does, I hate to say, doesn't know what he's doing, but he's not an OWCP attorney.
Right. They're not all created equal.
They're not all created equal. And I get calls all the time from personal injury attorneys who want us to associate in cases. That makes it very difficult because they've usually not done some things correctly from the beginning, which impacts this person. But this poor lady, now, she's going to be entitled to some scheduled awards. They're going to be minimal. But what's more important to her are the benefits she can derive for the rest of her life. So if things are done wrong from the beginning, it impacts you forever. And you know, it's very difficult to get in front of an audience of people who have never had a medical problem in the realm of their federal employment before.
Yeah.
They don't know that there's an issue until they have a problem, and then it's too late.
Too late.
So what you guys do as far as trying to educate these people and trying to get federal employees to tell their coworkers, hey, you need to go to a federal injury center, you need to seek help from the right people, is crucial to allowing them to access the entitlement that they have under the statute for the benefits that have been passed by Congress for them.
So report your injuries, go to federal injury centers.
Yeah. And yeah, there's nobody else out there. Federal injury centers are really, I mean, there's people that say that they take OWCP claims, doctors that say they take them.
What's your experience with those docs?
99% of them take an OWCP claim once and realize that it's not something they ever want to do again because they can't get paid.
Which is why there's so many docs listed on their provider search site, right?
They took it once. So
they took one patient and now they're listed.
They're listed on the site as somebody who's taken OWCP in the past, but they've learned they don't want OWCP claims so they can't get paid or it's very difficult to get paid.
Yeah.
You have to know the process. You have to know the causation standard. You have to know how to write it up and you have to know how to submit the paperwork.
Right.
Those are three distinct situations. I find it oftentimes, and especially in rural areas where there's not a federal injury center around, I'm trying to educate a physician's office on how to properly write something up and get it submitted. Now, when it comes to rating exams for schedule awards, it's an entirely unique process that, again, 99% of doctors in this country, is that Joe, is that accurate? 99% of doctors probably never do a rating exam? Is that?
Certainly not a six edition exam.
It's a big number because they say I don't do that, and I refer to someone else, typically an orthopedist who would do it.
Yeah. Well, and orthopedists don't do some of these exams, like a pulmonologist is needed for a lung condition, or if organs, sexual organs. I mean, an orthopedic is not the person for that. And I've seen those type of cases where somebody has lost a kidney, somebody has lost part of a lung, or whatever. I would have a hard time finding the physician to do that. Now, I could help the physician get through it because I understand the sixth edition, but I mean, there's even parts of the sixth edition that I would have difficulty with. So you can't expect a physician to understand them.
Okay. So I said this, I had no idea we're going to go down this path, but COVID, what are you seeing? You know, COVID's still like the newest disease that we have. We're still learning about it, you know, finding out new things about it. But as it applies, we're talking about schedule awards. Mm-hmm. What are you seeing with the way COVID is, you know,
here's the problem with COVID. The people that had extremely horrific COVID cases, and there's a lot of them out there. I've got one in a very rural area of North Carolina who will never return to work, but he's on OWCP forever because he can't work.
Mm-hmm.
So his entitlement to a scheduled award does not exist because he's on OWCP compensation.
But let's say hypothetically it would. How would it work? How do you get a scheduled award for well, COVID?
You have to have a pulmonary functional test, PFT. A pulmonary function test to see what the diminished capacity of the lungs are. And based upon that, you could apply for a scheduled award with a rating exam based upon the pulmonary function test. So there is a way to get the scheduled award for that. But again, everybody I've seen with long COVID is on OWCP, long-term disability compensation. If you want to apply for the scheduled award, which you can do, if you die from the condition, then you get your surviving representative can receive the scheduled award.
How many weeks is the lungs worth?
I don't know.
You didn't know.
I don't know. I think it's 156.
For everybody that wants to know, you can just Google schedule award chart, OWCP schedule award chart, and it'll be like the first thing on Google, and you can look at this chart that Eric's talking about.
I think it's 156 per lung, but pulmonary function tests are two lungs. So if you got a 10% deprivation, then you have a 31.2 week schedule award because it's two lungs.
31.2 weeks times
it's 15.6 times two.
Times your regular salary.
Based upon either a 75 or a 66 2/3% rate.
Right.
So again, there's no easy way to calculate this stuff out. Date of injury, pay rate comes into play, as does date of last exposure. A lot of people are disappointed because they're on OWCP for a number of years and they get their scheduled award and they've not gotten their step increases. It's frustrating. I understand that. That's the way the system is. You just have to take it for what it is. But the good thing is these scheduled awards are tax-free. So you don't have to pay taxes on the money you get from the government.
So let's talk money, because this is what really gets people going. What are the top five schedule award amounts you've ever gotten
top
for your clients?
Five?
Yeah. How much? You don't have to tell me who they are, what they did, unless you want.
One of them was $680,000.
$680,000.
Another one over $600,000. The one yesterday is over $500,000. But I'll say our average schedule award is $149,000. That's our average.
That's unreal. So I had no idea what you were going to say. I was about to ask you, what would you say the average is? I would have never guessed it would be that much.
149.
That was like three times more than what was in my head.
Well, it you know, most people that we take their case, they have significant knee and hip issues. Once you have osteoarthritis, it doesn't go away. If you get the knee or hip replacement, that changes everything, because that goes, if you're bone on bone, it's a 50% schedule award. If you get the replacement, it's generally a 25%.
Really? The award gets worse
with a replacement.
If they cut your bones out.
Yeah. Yes and no. If it's a bad result or you have a diminished range of motion, it can be higher. So we see a lot of times where a district medical advisor will say, hey, it's a joint replacement. It's 25% without ever looking at the diminished range of motion, which could increase it to 67%, depending upon what's going on. So we, again, driving that one case I was talking about before we went on yesterday, we had no expectation of an increase in the scheduled award, and it went from 23%, which they've rated it at, to 67% by our calculation. So I'm just now waiting for the district medical advisor to give his opinion, which I'm sure he'll confirm the second opinion doctor, and then we come in with our appeal. And our appeals, I know, piss off OWCP, because we're very technical, but the law is the law.
Yeah.
And we're willing to fight them. Nobody else is willing to fight them like we do. I've seen some appeals, but we do this every day. I mean, I would say we have pending right now 100 appeals on very technical issues, but it's significant increases. And we will not let the second opinions of the district medical advisors get away with not following the law. So we get in these discussions with the powers that be at the American Medical Association to make sure their guides are properly interpreted, and or they read the entire guides. Sometimes they just specialize in one chapter and forget the overarching principles and table 2.1 that has the fundamental principles of the guides. You got to point those things out.
Yeah.
Most people don't know they exist, let alone doctors don't know they exist and don't know how to interpret them. But that's what the law is. It's interpretation of the existing precedent to make sure it's followed.
So to this point, you've said that to qualify for a schedule award, you have to get a 6 edition rating. Your claim needs to be accepted, and it's got to be a rateable body part from the chart.
Yes.
What else do they have to do to get it a schedule? Yeah, a schedule award, because that's the next most common question is, how do I go about getting a schedule award?
Great question. First of all, you have to be a maximum medical improvement.
MMI. So for everyone out, yeah, you're going to hear the word MMI or the term MMI that stands for maximum medical improvement. It's a medical decision.
It's a medical determination.
Right.
I wouldn't say it's a decision because reasonable minds can differ. But all that means is that you're at a fixed, stable state. That does not necessarily mean you're no longer treating.
Right.
Because you can be at a fixed, stable state and still need treatment for pain. And we do see that a lot, especially with people who have a BMI over body mass index over 30. So they're not eligible under medical guidelines to get a knee replacement or a hip replacement. I understand why they don't want to do that. And some people have other conditions. Diabetes is, there's comorbidities that preclude people from getting things. So you can be at MMI, maximum medical improvement, and still need additional treatment. So a lot of times people call and say, well, I'm still treating, I'm not at MMI. That does not necessarily correlate. So it's a medical determination as to whether or not you're at a fixed medical state in your journey with this medical injury. Once you get there, you have to have a rating examination completed. A rating examination is not as simple as going to a doctor and having him look at you and make a determination as to what your impairment is. When we send somebody to one of our physicians, we have already collated, reviewed, and summarized their medical condition and medical history. That is a very, very big step because what that history tells you can impact the rating you're going to get. A lot of people just call and say, who's your doctor? It doesn't work that way. We don't just say, this is our doctor, because our doctor is going to say, we're not going to see them.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to put all this information together. They've got to collate it. They've got to give us a summary. They've got to give us the ability to start the process. That's just a start. Then the person goes to the physician for the rating exam. Range of motion is taken, and it's not one range of motion. It's multiple range of motions. A good rating exam hour or two by a doctor if he's going to take his time and do it right. I've seen upwards of 65 or 66 different range of motions for lower extremity determinations. A lot of times doctors will come in and you'll say, I need a rating exam on my knee. They'll look at the knee, they'll give a rating exam for the knee. Never look at the ankle or the hip, which leaves money on the table. It drives me flipping crazy when I see a rating exam come in where they just look at one part of a body member, body member being a leg or an arm that we're trying to get a rating for. And I see it every single day with doctors who either don't know how to properly rate, are too lazy to properly rate, or are trying to get it over with and get the person out the door by charging them the least amount of money, thinking that they're doing everything they need to do when they're not. So the rating exam itself is a very, it takes us months to do a rating exam. We have someone who requests all the medical records, who collates all the medical records. We have someone who schedules it. We have conversations with the person beforehand to tell them to make sure that the doctor does certain things. There's nothing worse than sending somebody to a second opinion exam, getting a call from our client, and they tell us what they did and they didn't do it right. Mm-hmm. I'm like, we just wasted $2,500 sometimes for a rating exam and it wasn't done properly.
Yeah.
Or they didn't consider something that they should have considered. So where we bring value is ensuring that the rating exam is done correctly. All the medical evidence is properly communicated with the physician's office and the physician. And we go back and forth with the doctor. The doctor will give us a preliminary report. We'll ask the doctor if they consider this or that. And the way it's written up is very important. If it's not written up properly, the district medical advisor who's going to review it at OWCP is not going to properly calculate out what the, or concur or disagree with the rating physician. So this is not as simple as just saying, hey, I'm at MMI, I went and got a rating exam, and I want my rating paid. I've said often, I've told you, Chris, I could spend an entire career out of just going over rating exams that people have gotten paid on before and increasing their schedule awards significantly.
So that was going to be my next thing. It's more of a comment than a question, because you said that you frequently get people who come to you, they've already had their award, and then you find more money. Just left out there that they didn't know how to get.
If you've had a hip or knee replacement and you've gotten a schedule award, I would say in 50% of those cases, I can just look at the rating exam you got and increase it significantly because it was done wrong. And it's nothing against the doctors. I mean, it's kind of like a physician who's doing surgery on you. Do you want somebody who has a degree who's legally authorized to do the surgery? Do you want somebody that's done it 100 times? Right. I want somebody that's done it 100 times.
Yeah.
Just because they're capable, just because an attorney, you went to an attorney to get a rating exam done, does not necessarily mean it was done right. You've got to have someone who specializes in that. And that's what we specialize in. We've got four attorneys who do nothing but rating exams for scheduled awards. And again, I've told people, and I've had attorneys come to me, can you teach me how to do this? No, it's going to take a year and a half of my full-time attention just to teach you how to do this.
And you have a lot of clients you got to deal with in that time.
I don't have the time. We bring on sparingly. We've got four lawyers. We're going to bring on one more next year, but he's been working with me for 2 years now. He's in law school. I'm teaching him how to do this right, and he'll come on and he'll learn it our way.
Yeah.
And again, I'm sure we're going to talk about it. There's a big change coming in with regard to schedule award acquisition. So you've got to do it right from the beginning. It's a team process with the physicians we have on board. And I know I've told federal injury centers, it's not a moneymaker for you guys to do rating exams. I'm concerned that they're not going to be done right because you have so many people across the country and they're so technical to do. The easy ones are carpal tunnel syndrome. It's 2%. I can tell you right now, if you got CTS in each arm, it's 1% per arm, it's 2%.
Right.
If you have a, rotator cuff tear with a bicep tendon tear and probably a slap tear, a superior labrum anterior to posterior tear, it's probably 12% rating. So I can, if you just tell me what your diagnosis is, I can tell you what the rating's going to be.
Yeah.
But when this changes with the change from the 6th to the 5th edition, I can't do that any longer. We were talking about it this afternoon here in the office, what we're going to have to do when this changes. And what's going on is OWCP.
Yeah, explain the change that's coming.
OWCP has been proposing for a while, and this is based upon Director Chris Godfrey, who's the director of OWCP, coming from the state of Iowa, where they use the 5th edition. Mm-hmm. The 6th edition was implemented in 2009, and the U.S. Department of Labor went to that as a standard for schedule awards. They're changing it so that you can use the 5th or the 6th edition. So what that means is you're going to have to
get... Let me pause you. For everyone out there that doesn't speak medical, the 5th edition and 6th edition essentially look like textbooks.
Oh, they're
textbooks. We're literally talking about textbooks.
600-page textbooks for each of them. We're going to have to rate it under the 5th edition and under the 6th edition, and the claimant is entitled to the higher of the two.
So now the doctor's got to be an expert in the 5th and 6th, and they're already making mistakes just with the 6th.
Yes, but doctors have more experience with the 5th.
Yeah.
And the 5th is generally a higher rating. Is that fair?
It is.
However, in order to make the determination as to which is going to be a higher rating, I've got to see the range of motion determinations from the physician. And again, it's going back and forth with the physician and discussing with the physician. You've got to have a physician who's willing to talk. Most doctors, I think, God bless them, because when you need them, you got to have them, have a little bit of an attitude. And they don't want to hear from somebody else that there's a different way to consider something. So we have physicians that we use regularly and we go back and forth with, and they're willing to listen to us. And that's all I say, listen to what our position is.
They still have to make medical decisions.
They have to make the decision. It's their name. It's being signed on the paper. So I fully respect their ultimate authority and decision-making process. But you've got to have somebody who's willing to listen and somebody who understands the guides. So we now have to do a 6th edition and a 5th edition, make the determination as to what's higher. Although I think with joint replacements, I think the 6th edition is going to come out a little bit better for people. Again, if you've had a schedule award before for a joint replacement, it's worth a phone call to let us take a look at the rating exam to see if they screwed it up. Because I see it all the time. They've left so much money on the table, it's ridiculous.
So I have two more questions, and we'll wrap it up. But this is also a really common question that we get all the time. I had my schedule award, and 10 years later, I'm worse. What do you do?
Well, once OWCP owns a body part, they own it for life. So I get this question a lot. We get somebody to schedule award who's bone on bone in the knee. A year later, they need a knee replacement, and they don't know if they can come back in and ask OWCP to pay for that knee replacement. They absolutely can.
Of course.
And they should. It does take a little bit of work to get it approved, and a lot of people get frustrated with the process and just say, screw it, I'm going to use my insurance. And I don't blame them.
Yeah.
I mean, the system sucks. But I'm sorry, the question was,
what happens if my I get worse after the award is paid to me?
And that happens a lot. We were in here talking before we started this about somebody who has a increase in joint interval space measurement. Maybe it's 3.6 millimeters today. In 2 years, it's 2.1 millimeter. They got paid a schedule award for the 3.6 millimeter. Now it's on the 2.1. We can go back in and get an increase in the schedule award, so more money.
You didn't you just say earlier we can just round up?
Rounding is not something that it's not a good topic right now. We're right on that; they're wrong. But honestly, you know, the people at OWCP and Chris Godfrey, the director, he often tells his claims examiners that oftentimes the claimant's only representative is the claims examiner. So claims examiners have to be compassionate. It's a non-adversarial process. I say that with in tongue in cheek because a lot of times I find it adversarial, but it's supposed to be non-adversarial. These claims examiners are supposed to be helping people. They have 400 to 500 cases. They can't put the time and effort they need into each case. So people need representatives who understand this process. And I mean, I'm friends with a lot of claims examiners. I think that they're good people, but they're overworked. And a lot of times they don't have the experience level they need. It's no negative reflection upon them. They just don't have.
They want to do a great job. I mean, the couple that I know are really passionate about doing a great
job. They are. And they just don't know the process. And I got in a rather, I don't want to say heated, but interesting discussion yesterday with a claims examiner supervisor who was trying to tell me that I can't have two bases for causation, an aggravation and direct cause. And I'm absolutely, you can. That's exactly what the statute says. And I got frustrated. I said, just deny it. Deny it. So let me, I can appeal it and get it to a higher authority and show you that you're wrong.
Right.
But you've got to know when to do that. A poor claimant who's sitting in that situation has no idea how to deal with that issue and no idea how to appeal it, what the best appeal option is, what the quickest way to get paid is. I see people all the time who are literally relying upon family members to put food on their table because they're not getting paid. You guys see it all the time. It's sad.
We just met somebody who had to move back in with her parents.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's very sad.
Yeah.
We see it all the time. And if federal injury centers weren't out there, I know WCP doesn't necessarily like federal injury centers because you guys know how to get claims accepted, but it is what it is. I mean, that's the system that's out there. You're following the law, you're following the procedure. And I just, in this transition from the sixth edition to including the fifth edition, they're putting provisions in there that are right in line with the business model of federal injury centers, that you can now go to a PA or a nurse practitioner to do the rating exam so long as it's signed off on by a physician, which is exactly what your business model is.
Yeah.
They're realizing that they cannot get doctors across the country who are willing to take OWCP cases because of the complexity. OWCP, Director Godfrey, has gone out there and tried to get insurance plans to include federal workers. They want nothing to do with it because they know how difficult the process is. And even if they did, for some reason, say, okay, we'll take OWCP patients, they would discontinue it in a month because it's so difficult.
For sure, it's no so doubt about it.
So
I always say that for the however many offices we do have, at any given time, I never know. There was at least 100 that said no. For every one that said yes, there's another 100 that said no, I don't want to touch that. And that's the problem. There's whole states with no doctors.
Alaska is one. Alaska has no federal injury doctor.
Anywhere in the middle of the country, there's nobody.
Yeah, I know.
You can go multiple states and not find a single doctor.
And I get the calls all the time, especially when people are in accidents, because you've gotten the word out, hey, you need to talk to somebody who's a federal injury specialist, a federal injury attorney specialist. They've got an attorney who's desperate for help. And I have them all the time give the case up. Here, you take the case. I realize and recognize that the better benefits this person is going to receive are lifetime benefits from OWCP rather than a quick settlement on a PI case, personal injury case. So we end up with those all the time. But then the problem is finding somebody to treat them.
Yeah.
Because there's nobody in that state that will treat. Now I'm literally helping physicians write the medical reports based upon their findings to appease OWCP to get the claim accepted or to get the claim expanded or to get the surgery necessary for the person to get better. It's difficult. It's a difficult job. And that's why I've specialized. It was too much to try to do everything. Schedule awards, it's palatable to me to send somebody a bill because they're getting a benefit and they recognize the value of our work. Our, again, the average award is 49,000. Our average bill is about 19,000. So it's about 12%. In the state workers' compensation arena, attorneys take 25%.
Right.
So we're taking less than half of what a state workers' compensation attorney takes. The difference is we get paid by a client. In the state system, the attorneys get paid and then pay the client. So there's a trust issue both ways. We trust the clients to pay us. The clients trust us for our ability to get them better benefit.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, and I think some of your air quote competitors do what I'm about to say. Is correct me if I'm wrong though. You are by law not allowed to take a percentage. Right? Yes. And I still hear of some lawyers taking percentages. Well, so you're not even allowed to.
Don't conflate that with a maximum percentage. So we will not take more than 33% of what we get somebody. So I can have a case where I put $50,000 worth of work in, but the person only gets a $60,000 scheduled award. I will not take more than 33% of any benefit we get.
So you cap it.
I cap it at 33%. Sometimes people conflate that with you're taking a third. I'm not taking more than a third.
Right.
But yes, you are right. There are certain people out there, and it's not a matter of ill intent. It's a matter of uneducation by some by some attorneys. I see personal injury attorneys say, I'm going to take a third of the case.
Well, they're used to it. That's what they do.
And they get a scheduled award and take a third of it. So, yeah, it's illegal, and it's personal liability for the attorney. And plus, it's malpractice.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, again, there's nobody that does what we do. We are the only firm in the country that specializes in scheduled awards. I love the arena we're in. I love helping people. I love getting them
up. Okay, so I'm going to shove this question in, and I'll ask my last question. Because this happens all the time too. I'll have somebody say, can you get me in touch with Eric? And they're represented by somebody else already. So explain to people why you will not help those people at that time.
Attorneys are licensed by states. I'm licensed in North Carolina. I'm licensed in Ohio. I'm not active in Ohio. I've been gone from there for a long time. But we have certain rules we have to live by. One of those rules is that if a person is represented by another attorney, I cannot even talk to them about their case.
What could happen to you if you did?
Well, it invades upon the purview of the attorney-client relationship, and I will not do it. If somebody calls me and says, hey, I have a lawyer, I'm like, I can't talk to you. I'm sorry. I will not violate my rules of ethics for a case.
There you go.
So it is what it is. I am glad to talk to another attorney, and I do often. I get calls from attorneys all the time. Hey, I've got a case. It's partially federal workers' compensation. And I will try to talk the attorney through what they need to do. And I'll tell them outright, you can't do this. It's too much. It's difficult for me. It's impossible for you. So I won't talk to them, basically, is what it comes down to if they tell me they're represented by another lawyer or anybody in my firm.
But you have rules. Bottom line, you have rules and you follow them.
Yes.
All right. So this is my last question. In order to be able to report an injury, you have to report it within 3 years. In order,
you're not gonna like my answer.
No, because there's an exception to everything. To get a CA-16, you have to report within 7 days. To get COP, you have to report within 30 days. To do a reconsideration, it's got.